Alliance for Justice presents Senator Edward M. Kennedy with a major policy speech on constitutional checks and balances, the Supreme Court, and judicial nominations. It preceded a special screening of Alliance for Justice's provocative short documentary, Quiet Revolution. It was recorded Wednesday, March 28th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Senator Kennedy was introduced by Alliance for Justice President Nan Aaron. For further information, visit allianceforjustice.org.
It's great to see all of you here today, and it's certainly a pleasure to have Senator Kennedy. It's been said of Senator Kennedy that he does not compromise where the United States Constitution is at issue. Or, to put it more simply, he gets it. And nobody gets it quite like Senator Kennedy. He's fought for the poor, for the sick and the elderly, for those shut out from the American dream because of skin color or because they were women. And he's fought for those who seek justice in our courts. He's not only fought so hard, he's achieved so much. When Time magazine named him one of America's best senators, he was praised for amassing, quote, a titanic record affecting the lives of virtually every man, woman, and child in the country. But Senator Kennedy never rests on his laurels, nor is he deterred by his detractors. In this new Senate, as we continue to bring fairness to our courts, he will lead us again. He sees the stakes, sees the strategy, and will see the battle through. There is no one in America who has achieved more personal distinction than this great leader. Meanwhile, not just for what he says today, but for what he has done every day, it is an honor to introduce you, the senior senator from Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you, Nan, and so much for your kind words and for your presentation, and also for the opportunity to meet with a group that I have such a high regard and respect for. I commend the Alliance for its long-standing commitment to the rule of law and your dedication to liberty, justice, and opportunity for all. You've been a pioneer in educating the public about the impact of the federal courts on Americans' everyday lives, and the important film you will present today continues that very vital and important service. At the heart of many of the serious challenges we face is the Bush administration's lack of respect for the rule of law. The administration's view our system of justice as merely another arena for furthering its right-wing ideology. It sees the Senate constitutional role in confirming those who enforce our laws as a roadblock to be circumvented whenever possible. The ongoing scandal over the firing of U.S. Attorneys is a stunning example. Using a stealth provision slipped into the Patriot Act reauthorization, the administration has replaced U.S. attorneys without Senate review. And each day the evidence grows that the White House fired U.S. attorneys because they balked at using the enormous power of federal law enforcement to serve the partisan ends of the Republican Party. Carol Lamb in San Diego had been too vigorous in pursuing corrupt Republican Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham. David Iglesias in New Mexico had refused to indict Democrats before last November's election. John McKay in the state of Washington had refused to pursue voter fraud charges as a means of challenging a Democrat's close victory in the 2004 election for governor. Equally disturbing, several of the U.S. attorneys appointed without Senate review have scant litigation experience but deep partisan credentials. For instance, Bradley Schlossman, the new U.S. attorney for the Western District of Missouri, was involved in the politicization of the Justice Department's voting rights enforcement eras. After President Bush took office in 2001, the department filed only one case alleging race discrimination against African Americans in voting, but it took a number of steps to undermine voting rights for partisan gains. In 2003, Mr. Schlossman and other political appointees approved Tom DeLay's Texas redistricting scheme over the unanimous objections of career staff that the plan discriminated against Latino voters. The Texas plan was later struck down by the Supreme Court because of its discriminatory effect. In 2005, Mr. Schlossman again overrode career professionals in improving a Georgia voter identification requirements for voting that clearly discriminated against minority voters. That law was later blocked by a federal court that compared it to a 21st century poll tax. Mr. Schlossman also was involved in filing amicus briefs in the key battleground states of Florida, Michigan, Ohio in 2004, seeking to prevent the counting of provisional ballots in the presidential election. Other attorneys with relatively little litigation experience but strong partisan credentials have been placed in U.S. attorneys' positions in states likely to be vital in the 2008 election, such as Florida, Iowa, Minnesota, and Arkansas, to name a few. Add to this that John McKay and David Iglesias were removed in battleground states because of their unwillingness to pursue meritless voter fraud allegations. Tim Griffin, Karl Rove's former deputy, was sent to Arkansas. The conclusion is inescapable that the administration has methodically placed reliable partisans in positions where they can influence the outcome of the 2008 elections. The havoc the administration has played with the Justice Department is complemented by the damage it has done to the courts. In choosing nominees for the federal courts, particularly the Supreme Court, President Bush selected ideologues and then sought to circumvent the process by which the Senate obtains information about the nominees' legal views. In my years in the Senate, I've had the honor of participating in 23 Supreme Court nominations, including nominations for each of the justices now serving on the court and hundreds of lower court judges. More than any other president before him, George Bush has succeeded in denying the Senate the information it needs to make informed judgments about nominees to the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts. Despite days of testimony, the hearings for John Roberts and Samuel Alito served only to obscure the legal views and philosophies that would guide their work if confirmed. The film Quiet Revolution comes at a time when the Supreme Court nomination process is in need of a serious overhaul. And I intend to work with Senator Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and my colleagues on the committee to ensure that the process again becomes a means for learning about legal views and philosophies before a nominee is confirmed. The breakdown in the nomination process matters because the Supreme Court decides issues of enormous importance to Americans' daily lives. The confirmation process is the Senate's constitutionally conferred opportunity to determine whether that nominee deserves to be entrusted with this awesome responsibility. In the past, questions asked at confirmation hearings, together with candidates' records, often gave senators a solid basis for deciding whether or not to confirm a nominee. In fact, I voted for 3 of the 5 Supreme Court nominees, justices nominated by President Reagan. In rare instances, it may be possible to know from the nominees' records alone whether they should be confirmed. In most cases, though, a realistic exchange during the hearings is invaluable. This is particularly true when, as in the Roberts and Alito nominations, a president intentionally selects nominees for their legal views and for their lack of a paper trail that would reveal such views. In past years, Senate questioning of nominees generally served well the framers' desire to ensure checks and balances in appointing Supreme Court justices. The system worked as it was intended in 1970, when President Nixon's nomination of Harold Carswell was derailed after the Senate discovered his segregationist past. The process also worked in 1987, when the Senate rejected Robert Bork's extreme views, prompting President Reagan to nominate the more moderate Anthony Kennedy, who was confirmed unanimously. The confirmation process broke down, however, because the Bush administration learned the wrong lesson from the Bork nomination. It decided it could still nominate extremists as long as their views were not well known. The previous Bush administration tried a similar approach with Clarence Thomas's nomination, but the current White House turned the effort to hide nominees' views into an art form. It insisted that the Senate must confirm its inquiry largely to a nominee's personal qualities and coached its nominees to evade the committee's questions. Many Republican senators used their time to praise, not probe, the nominees. Guided by White House aides, the nominees resisted attempts to explore their judicial philosophies. As a result, the thoughtful exchanges of past hearings were replaced by carefully directed theater, which left the committee with only hints about how nominees viewed the major legal issues of the day. That's unacceptable. Qualified Supreme Court nominees are selected from among the nation's most seasoned and intellectually rigorous lawyers, scholars, and judges. Of course, they have thought deeply about the law and have substantive views on important legal issues. At the very least, they have read and debated the major cases that every first-year law student has read, and they can intelligently discuss whether they agreed or disagreed with those cases. Instead of substantive answers on these issues, Roberts and Alito worked hard to give the impression of moderation. Over and over, they assured us that they would not bring an ideological agenda to the bench. After confirmation, we saw an entirely different side of Judges Roberts and Alito. Although it's still very early in their terms on the court, they have already begun to reveal themselves as ideologues ready and willing to tilt the court away from core protections important to the American people. In fact, in their very first term on the court, according to a report completed at Georgetown University Law Center, they voted together in 91% of all cases and 88% of non-unanimous cases, more than any other two judges. They have held that the First Amendment does not protect public workers who blow the whistle on internal fraud and corruption. They have sought to radically cut back the Clean Water Act, which protects our natural heritage from pollution. The topics in which their decision raises the greatest concerns, however, are among those that were most troubling during their confirmation hearings: government power and civil rights. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito have voted repeatedly to expand the power of the state at the expense of cherished individual rights. Their position is particularly troubling in the light of the Bush administration's unprecedented effort to expand presidential power. It claims that the president can arrest American citizens on American soil and jail them for years without access to counsel or the courts. It claims that the president can open the mail of U.S. citizens and spy on persons on American soil without the court order required by law. The administration even believes that torture can be an acceptable practice, despite laws and treaties that have expressly prohibited it. Seldom has the nation been more in need of a Supreme Court that will restrain a president who overreaches. But the records of the two newest justices give little hope that they will do so. In Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, the court reviewed the constitutionality of President Bush's military commissions, created to judge alleged enemy combatants in secret and without the protections typically afforded criminal defendants. The court held that the president had violated both the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Conventions by establishing the commissions without congressional authority. Justice Alito disagreed, although during his confirmation hearing, he claimed no longer to believe, as he had written in a 1985 job application, very strongly in the supremacy of the elected branches of government. Although Chief Justice Roberts did not participate in the Hamdan Supreme Court decision, as a Court of Appeals judge in the same case, he too had sided with the president. Justices Roberts and Alito have both sought to narrow individual protections against governmental power. They joined a 5-4 opinion in Hudson versus Michigan, holding that your home is no longer your castle, rejecting almost a century of precedent that ruled that evidence obtained in unconstitutional searches of American homes can be used to convict them. Justice Alito had replaced Justice O'Connor, and his vote probably changed the outcome of the case. The new justices' records also raise alarm bells in civil rights. As an official in the Reagan Justice Department, Roberts had opposed the Civil Rights Restoration Act of 1988 and sought to narrow Title IX's protection against sex discrimination in education and opposed the Civil Rights Restoration Act. He also worked extensively but unsuccessfully to block efforts to outlaw unfair tactics that dilute minorities' votes. Memoranda he drafted made clear that his opposition to the amendment reflected not only the Reagan administration's position, but his own strongly personally held beliefs. During the Senate hearing on his nomination, I asked about his views on the Voting Rights Act, particularly his statement that the Act's protections against vote dilution was one of the most intrusive interferences imaginable by federal courts into state and local processes. In response, he suggested that his words were nothing more than an effort to articulate the views of the administration for which I worked. Today, too late, it's clear that Chief Justice Roberts' personal views is the same as the position he advocated then. In Lulac v. Perry, the Supreme Court held that Tom DeLay's Texas redistricting plan violated the Voting Rights Act by excluding many Latinos from the district at a time when their numbers had become large enough for Latinos to elect a representative of their choice. Chief Justice Roberts denied the obvious injustice. He concluded that the court should not have been involved and that it is a sordid business, this divvying us up by race. Fortunately, a majority of the court understood that the Voting Rights Act, far from dividing America, keeps the divisions that already exist in our society from shutting minorities out of the political process. Even worse, although he did not participate in the LULAC case, it appears that Justice Alito may become the member of the court most hostile to civil rights. In the Burlington, Northern, and Santa Fe Railroad versus White, the court reviewed the claim of a working mother whose employer had subjected her to shift changes, undesirable job assignments, poor job reviews after she complained of sexual harassment. Justice Alito was the only member of the court who argued that Title VII protects workers only from limited kinds of retaliation. The comments of Justice Roberts and Alito at argument in the Seattle and Louisville voluntary integration cases also did not inspire confidence, although it is, of course, a mistake to assume too much from justices' questioning at oral argument. At his nomination hearing, Chief Justice Robert had testified that the court in Brown versus Board of Education was right to look at the discrimination in context. But his questions at the oral argument ignored context, drawing no distinction between the stigmatizing segregation at issue in Brown and present-day efforts to achieve integration so that all children enjoy the benefit of a diverse learning environment. Although Justice Alito had testified at his confirmation hearing that he valued having a diverse group of students in the classrooms he taught as a law professor, he seemed unwilling to recognize the importance of diversity in the voluntary integration cases. It's too soon to know for certain, but the oral argument suggests that the praise the new justices heaped on the Brown versus Board at their confirmation hearings will ring hollow once the final votes are counted in the voluntary integration cases. At a time when vast legal issues are being decided by the slimmest of margins, we cannot afford to learn a nominee's views only after they have obtained lifetime tenure on the nation's highest court. The only way to know whether a nominee will meet the high bar for confirmation is to have an honest, in-depth exchange during the nomination process. The Judiciary Committee, the Senate, and the American Bar Association need to work together with the White House to make that happen. I support reform despite my belief that the next justice will be nominated by a Democratic president and be sent to a Democratic Senate for confirmation. Reform should begin with a few basic changes. We must somehow put the advice back into the constitutional requirement that nominees be appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate. As you know, the last great decision that was made at the Constitutional Convention was the division on the advice and consent provisions to the Constitution. Up to the last 10 days, the appointment power was retained by the Senate of the United States. The Senate of the United States was responsible for the totality of filling the Article III judges. And it was only in the last 10 days that the division was made. And no one can read the history of the debates of the Constitutional Convention and not understand that this was a shared responsibility and a shared power between the executive and between the United States Senate. In the recent nominations of Justice Alito and Roberts, President Bush made token calls to many of us in the Senate before announcing his selections, but it was clear his decision had already been made. A better course would be to allow real advice and consultation before making a choice. In addition, any qualified nominee to the Supreme Court will have spent many years thinking about legal issues. We should require that nominees share their thinking with the Judiciary Committee and not pretend that such candor is tantamount to prejudging specific cases. We know from their past decisions how most of the current justices interpret Roe v. Wade. Yet, they are not precluded from sitting on future cases involving abortion. Why then shouldn't we also know how Supreme Court nominees view Roe v. Wade and other important legal decisions? The Judiciary Committee also needs to improve how it obtains information. An in-depth inquiry requires more than short rounds of questions that move from senator to senator. The Senate should insist on having the same access to the nominee's writings and other relevant documents as the administration has. And it should receive those records before the hearing. Each member of the committee should have the right to submit a limited number of written questions to the nominee, where the nominee should answer in writing and detail under oath before the confirmation hearings. This will enable senators to go into greater depth in the hearings themselves, and it'll give the Senate and the American people valuable information in considering nominees. In addition, no senator should accept incomplete answers from a nominee about important legal issues, regardless of which party's president made the nomination. Nor should nominees who have served as high-ranking government officials, as Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito did, get away with claiming they were just representing a client when asked about advice they gave in their roles as legal policy advisors. Only if every member of the Senate insists on responsiveness from the nominees will we restore open dialogue to the nomination process. As Senator Spector wrote in his book, Passion for Truth, the Senate should resist, if not refuse, to confirm Supreme Court nominees who refuse to answer questions on fundamental issues. In voting on whether or not to confirm a nominee, senators should not have to gamble or guess about a candidate's philosophy, but should be able to judge on the basis of the candidate's expressed views. Finally, and above all, we must remember what this process is all about. It's nice to hear that a nominee has a loving family, faithful friends, and a sense of humor. It's important to know that the nominee possesses the intellect, life experience, and discipline to make a good judge. But it's essential that we learn enough about their legal views to be certain that they will make good on the simple promise engraved in marble over the entrance of the Supreme Court of the United States, equal justice under law. I commend all of you at the Alliance for all you do so well to keep those four basic words at the heart of this all-important debate. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll watch the Alliance's important documentary, Quiet Revolution. Thank you.
For further information, visit allianceforjustice.org.